I have some stage setting to do, but luckily Robert went before me and did a little bit of stage setting on the sort of physics side that I don't have to do. So my talk is called Where Effective Field Theory Fails. So we've heard a little bit now, a little bit at the end of yesterday, about reasons why we might expect effective field theory to fail. So I'll go through that bit a little bit quicker, and I think try to present a little bit more of a sort of philosophical musings take on this sort of stuff to provide a slightly different perspective. So a quick plan of attack, talk a little bit about effective field theory, separation of scales, and talk about this sort of tension between theoretical, having theoretical anomalies but not having empirical anomalies, and the sort of difference in attitudes that one might take there. I'll talk a little bit about how I think about conceptual shifts in science and how those are best approached and the best sort of methods to furnish that, and then go back to thinking about how we can hunt for empirical anomalies that would actually be persistent and worth pursuing. Cool. So yeah, we've heard a lot of criticism of effective field theory, but in some sense they're kind of frustratingly successful if you take them at face value. So Planckian censorship conjectures aside, or even that kind of is a sort of a by hand approach to think about, look, what, you know, if scales are separated like this, we really can't learn anything significant about high energy physics from the low energy physics. So that's kind of where I'll go here. But first, as an analytic philosopher, I want to lay all my cards on the table, kind of think about how I'm approaching thinking about looking for cracks for quantum gravity, as that's the title of this conference. We've seen some approaches, usually by physicists, of proposing specific models or higher level principles that go beyond current physics. I think that's a valuable way to go. I also think it's important to look at cracks in our current best theories, where they sort of break down, where they fail, as the best evidence, or as another source of evidence for constructing theories of quantum gravity. So like I said, I'm gonna start mostly with the particle physics side of effective field theories. Pay attention to the theoretical anomalies, keep an eye out for empirical anomalies, although those seem to be harder to come by. I'm focused on like the methodology of physics. So again, it's not necessarily whether we're gonna be right, but whether we have good reasons for pursuing certain approaches. And I'm also paying attention, which hasn't been talked about much, as the community aspect of physics. There's a sort of tension in the way I think about things if you think about it at an individual level, but you can kind of do a division of labor community-wise. So yeah, just quick background that, I mean, I'm sure you're all familiar with this. Effective field theory perspective on quantum field theories has been really powerful as a way of understanding and constructing effective theories fit for a certain range of energy scales. Kind of the approach is to target the appropriate degrees of freedom for a given energy scale, describe the dynamics via local interactions of those fields constrained by some sets of symmetries. We use sort of renormalization group methods to justify the construction and the sort of separation of scales that comes with those. And this has been really successful. We understand a lot about the standard model and physics sort of effective to that using this sort of approach, also in condensed matter physics. Some philosophers have taken this to be like a template for how we should understand theories in science generally, that perhaps we get this really nice way of thinking about theories that gives us a compatibility with between reduction, that ultimately everything is, you know, whatever is the fundamental level of physics, with emergence. This autonomy of scales gives an effective level of emergence. And there's some sort of implicit view often in these sorts of discussions that any successor theory will be expressible, at least in some regime, as an effective field theory. So you get this sort of tower. I did a really bad picture, but a tower of effective field theories here, where, you know, you have atoms at some scale, quantum fields at some scale, something else, quantum gravity maybe at a lower scale.
So I guess one question is it really a one-dimensional space? Because even length and energy are not the same thing.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So, yep. And then the question is, should it be in one dimension, or is it multiple dimensions?
Yeah, I mean, my criticisms go beyond that, but I think, yeah, you could even go at that point of, you know, there's sort of this implicit, like, oh, because we can Fourier transform in the right, if you have the right space-time backgrounds, that we can interchange between length and energy, but that's not always the case. I think that's one of the things that we should pay attention to, where effective field theories might break down even in the infrared rather than specifically just in the UV. Okay, yeah, this is all just background stuff. How renormalization group justifies effective field theory. As long as the energy scale for new physics is significantly higher than the scales at which we're using that theory, the high energy effects are just limited to setting the values of the coupling parameters that we can then fix via experiment. Yep.
Just a quick clarification. Are you thinking only of effective field theories which are natural? Or is this also for effective field theories in which your scale of suppression could also be multiplied by a large amount?
So I'm
secretly sneaking in naturalness.
Right now I'm assuming naturalness. The story gets complicated if you don't. My thought is that the failure of naturalness signals that this sort of kind of picture doesn't work well.
Can I just object to that? Because the effective field theory for GR and the standard one works tremendously well, and those are not natural. Right? We have at least three examples of parameters which are unnaturally small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So therefore, maybe the relevant thing to discuss would be the effective field theory paradigm in non-natural settings.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll get to the cosmological. I'm not talking specifically about GR, but I will get to the cosmological constant hierarchy problems. And I think those signal an interesting tension in how we think about effective field theories. But yeah, if you want to signal, just say like that's a failure of naturalness, and we can keep using effective field theories. Then I think that's compatible with this. I advocate going a little bit more conceptually away from effective field theories. So this is all should be familiar to most of you here. You know, we think of non-renormalizable terms which should spell disaster for effective field theories if they get suppressed at low energies. And so they only really become relevant as you start to approach the scale at which new physics comes in. And this, at least in sort of natural, if you're making assumptions of naturalness, gives you some bound on where you think the new physics scale has to be based on where you start to see non-renormalizable effects. But largely, high energy physics is irrelevant for low energy treatments. Is this sort of approach too successful? We've seen some small anomalies come up in the last few years for the standard model, but they keep seeming to be stubbornly. The tensions seem to keep dissolving, or the indication is that they will dissolve. So things like the W anomaly, the muon anomalous magnetic moment, though those aren't completely resolved, there's this big hype that Niyash was talking about, anomaly chasing, where, look, big result, something new, and then it kind of seems to go away over time. If you take this idea of the autonomy of scales and scale separation very seriously, we get this idea that, we really have no insight into high energy physics. So this is where the naturalness assumption comes in, that the autonomy of scales, it seems like we can construct effective field theories even in cases where we would expect where we know naturalness fails, where we think parameters should be quite a bit different for theoretical reasons than they are, like the Higgs mass and like the cosmological constant. If we take the sort of scaling from renormalization group methods seriously, we would expect those to signal a breakdown of the effective field theory methods, but it seems like they're not. So in some sense, the effective field theory approach without naturalness is more effective than we would expect it to be. We also have this sort of Weinberg-Folk theorem that any high energy theory at sufficiently low energies will look like a quantum field theory or some sort of effective field theory. So the question might be do we have any hope? we talk about cracks into quantum gravity, cracks from our current theories. It seems like, at least empirically, it's quite hard to find any. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't look. We should keep looking for anomalies. That is kind of the way that I think about this. So there's theoretical and empirical anomalies. The theoretical ones are more obvious and pressing. I'll get to empirical anomalies afterwards. The two big ones for the standard model, or standard model coupled to gravity, if you think about the cosmological constant problem, are the Higgs mass or the hierarchy problem and the cosmological constant problem. So yeah, this is where I think the community aspect comes in, thinking about how we should approach getting a solution. There's sort of two attitudes one should take. You should be skeptical and look at conceptual change when we're looking at these theoretical anomalies. Suggest that the standard model is more robust than at least the natural effective field theory paradigm would suggest. So in theory, you want to kind of think about making major changes, re-examine the foundations of the effective field theory perspective, what could be revised going forward for theory of quantum gravity. But for experiment, you kind of want to do the opposite. You want to really take the standard model, or at least, or like the standard model effective field theory, quite seriously. And you know, when you're discovering new physics, or you get these new precision tests, you really want to do as best you can with the tools that are already accepted to try to make the data fit. We talked a little bit yesterday about Newtonian astronomy and how that, you know, there was anomalies all the time, but they had faith in that paradigm in trying to fit the data. And it wasn't until that you have some really persistent anomalies, like in Mercury's perihelion precession, that those are the things that are really ripe for the to be treated with the new concepts on the theory side. So there's this sort of split kind of tension of attitudes of how you should approach. But yeah, if we think about this in a community level, you know, we can have one group that's really committed. Cliff Burgess is not here, but he's moving out on the experiment side. But like defenders of effective field theory try to, you know, you have these dialogues. Someone like Robert will propose that effective field theory is breaking and we need a whole new concept. And then Cliff Burgess will write a reply paper saying, no, actually, look, we can make a lot of this stuff fit. There's still some outstanding issues. And I think from the sort of methodology and progress of science perspective, that's a really healthy way of doing things. You should try to, we should be looking for new things, but we shouldn't just abandon what we have too hastily. So you have this sort of two-pronged attack. Yeah, so look at the theory stuff first. Okay, so I'm just going to skip over this for the sake of time. We all know the hierarchy problem, the Higgs mass, you know, should scale with the cutoff for the standard model effective field theory. The success of the standard model and the mass of the Higgs have a tension with that, again, assuming naturalness, that there's not some unnatural coupling parameters or fine-tuning or something like that. So you get this, with naturalness, you get this idea that either new physics should be observable at LHC scales now, or our theoretical understanding of relevant scaling parameters, there's something wrong there. You have a similar issue with the cosmological constant that's in some ways worse. It's in some ways better. It's worse in the sense that the scaling is even higher, you know, fourth power of the cutoff. So depending on where you exactly place that cutoff for the standard model, somewhere from like 40 to 120 orders of magnitude of disagreement with what the cosmological constant should be, assuming sort of naturalness and assuming renormalization group scaling is correct. But it's kind of, at least from the particle physics perspective, I know we're in a seminar on quantum gravity, but it's less of an issue because it only comes up in the context of merging the standard model, or like putting vacuum energy into a semi-classical gravitational treatment. And I mean, that's not, you know, that's a successful theory, but it's in a more speculative, slightly more speculative domain. So those are the main problems we're all familiar with. Now here comes some philosophy. So this is maybe a change of pace from the rest of the conference so far. I've kind of hinted at this already, but if we look, I mean, this kind of comes from Kuhn, but I'm going to go a little bit in a slightly different direction from Kuhn, but I think he set up the problem nicely, but there's too much of a focus on revolutions that I think has been an issue. But there is this sort of interesting tension in the development of physics between continuity at one level, you know, at the sort of empirical prediction, sort of phenomenology level, and radical change in terms of the conceptual foundations of theories. So the continuity is clear. You know, we wouldn't accept a new theory if it doesn't explain the successes of past theories. I mean, it can correct them, it can limit the domain of applicability, but it can't just say that, you know, we shouldn't be building bridges using, you know, classical statics, that we should actually have this whole radically different approach. You know, the successes of our past theories must be explained. But there's this sort of radical change at the foundations when we think about what, you know, really exists in the world, what the fundamental nature of reality is, what the relevant degrees of freedom are, what sort of worldview we get. You know, we go from Newtonian point particles, perhaps, to quantum particles, to quantum fields, to, you know, we go from gravity as this unexplainable universal attraction to mediated by fields. So there's this sort of tension that goes on, and I think this is something that I'm sure you're all familiar with and needs to be balanced. And again, I'm not departing from Kuhn yet. Anomalies are usually what indicate, persistent anomalies, I should say, are what indicate conceptual change. We don't have, unfortunately, philosophers of the 20th century came to frustrating conclusions that there just aren't these like tried and true single methods of science, of how you do science, and they're like a recipe for success. But there are sort of heuristics and guidelines, and some of those, one of these being that, you know, you should really take anomalies, either theoretical or empirical, quite seriously, and really try to resolve them. So on the side that if I'm thinking about conceptual change, we're thinking about the anomalies, the sort of failure of naturalness, or the weird, you know, the hierarchy problem, the cosmological constant problem, things like that. We should really take those seriously as guides for going forward. We should also take empirical anomalies, but again, for the standard model, there are much clearer theoretical anomalies than there are sort of empirical discrepancies that we can really latch our teeth into.
Do you want to define theoretical anomaly, because it's not quite clear?
Okay, so yeah, it's kind of heuristic. So an anomaly, you know, something that doesn't quite fit what we would expect. So on the theoretical side, I guess, like there's some sort of, you know, our conceptual framework is pointing in one direction, but it's not like, there's not really like a good, I don't have like a clear definition of this, but it's something where we'd expect on the basis of theory one thing, but then our theories are kind of telling us something else. So like on the basis of renormalization group scaling with sort of naturalness, we would expect certain values or certain ranges of values for what the Higgs mass might be or what the cosmological constant might be. And we're not getting those. And it's showing that the assumptions aren't being applied consistently. Like the way that I think about it is that the assumptions aren't being applied consistently. There's a problem with how our theory handles relevant scaling parameters for the standard model. So that's like a concrete example. I don't have like a general philosophical definition.
For example, the fact that if you reach somewhere around Planck scale or below, quantum mechanics and gravity would then be consistent with each other. That's I guess an anomaly. But the other is like the cosmological constant is not natural. Are they the same kind of anomalies, or do you call both of them anomalies? Or not?
I would say they both, like at this sort of broad strokes, I would say they're kind of, there's obviously differences between them, but I think that those fall under theoretical anomalies. You might think of like trans-Planckian censorship as a sort of conjecture to cut off something that might be a theoretical anomaly. We don't think, you know, we assume separation of scales for effective field theories. If trans-Planckian modes cross and be classicalized and become super Hubble, that kind of, that breaks down that separation of scales. So in order to preserve that, we like impose this more or less justified sort of thing. So that would be another example of a theoretical anomaly with effective field theories. This is where I'm going to speculate about where I think the ways forward are a little bit. So this is kind of what we were talking about a little bit yesterday. That the effective field theory treatment with renormalization group and naturalness seems to break down for these relevant parameters, at least in the standard model. There's effective field theories that below that energy often are quite successful. It just seems to be that for the standard model, these seems to start breaking down. So it seems like the standard model, just as a renormalizable theory, seems to be more effective than you would expect, are more predictively accurate than you would expect if you were using standard effective field theory treatments and looking at the scaling behavior. So one thing with the hierarchy problem that's sort of unique is that it's a direct empirical evidence. We can measure the Higgs mass directly. That we don't have to. There's no sort of theoretical mediation like with the cosmological constant problem. That one's kind of in some sense more pressing because there's direct empirical evidence, and you know, attempts to try to restore it in a natural way. For both the cosmological constant hierarchy problem, whether we add new forces like a grand unified theory or something like supersymmetry, these seem to be getting continuously kind of disfavored. So maybe that's evidence that just trying to rescue the sort of naturalness and effective field theory paradigm is not the way to go. Chris and I have a paper on more detail on the cosmological constant problem. I think this one is a little bit less direct because, again, you have to sort of assume that the expectation value of vacuum energy density in quantum field theory, which without gravity has no sort of, it's not empirically measurable. You have to assume it couples to gravity in a certain way. And that's sort of the normal, like it's the natural way you'd expect things to couple, but there's room for kind of wiggle room getting out of that as well. And so this is where I think there's another interesting case of effective field theories breaking down in the IR. So when we kind of extrapolate from local effective field theories to thinking about cosmological observables, there's a potential that we get like lack sort of background space-time symmetry structure, the right sort of structure to define even an energy scale that extrapolates to those scales. And so that's hinting in a slightly different direction than the hierarchy problem, though theoretically they're quite similar. It's just relevant scaling parameters. So those are kind of my rough thoughts, but just generally, how should we go forward? What concepts should we change if you buy the fact that we need to go beyond effective field theories? We've heard some suggestions. Robert just had some. Laurent mentioned some in the discussion yesterday. One way that I think hasn't been discussed yet that I think is important as not just for the standard model, but for kind of general lessons in history of philosophy of science is that reformulations of theories and sort of different formalisms can often be really enlightening for the best way forward. So we currently have like this sort of effective field theory approach for understanding the standard model. And that comes with this sort of we need these sort of background symmetry structures and energy scales, and we do perturbations around vacuum states usually. But maybe there's some sort of reformulation that we could get for quantum field theory that would point us in the right sorts of directions, the same way that it would have been really hard to get to quantum mechanics naturally from Newton's three laws. It took hundreds of years to go to Lagrangian, Hamiltonian sort of formulations. And then there's sort of this natural, not in the moment, but we can look back and like natural quantization procedure that kind of connects those two formalisms. So maybe there's something similar to be said for either general relativity or the standard model. Again, some concrete suggestions that have been mentioned. UVIR mixing would kind of be a very concrete example of the failure of separation of scales, undermine the whole EFT program. Some sort of breakdown of locality. So we always assume that we can model at least effectively at some energy scale interactions as like local point interactions with the quantum fields. If we had some models that violate those assumptions, string theory is one, obviously at some point with the string scale at least, that point particle sort of that point interaction breaks down. As I mentioned briefly, the failure of global extrapolation of local physics might be another a way to go. So if we start thinking about quantum cosmologies or something like that. So those are all like the big, that's the one side of the tension, the radical conceptual shifts. What do we need to do? I'm a philosopher. I get to pass the buck to the physicists in terms of what's going to actually work and concrete proposals. But those are just some sort of conceptual suggestions. But again, we should think about the sort of more conservative side. Always, being really attentive to what relevant limits of whatever new conceptual framework we have will lead us to effective field theories or classical general relativity and the appropriate limits, why those will emerge. So you can think about, obviously the sort of easy way to think about those is, different values of constants as they become, ratios of constants become important. So like special relativity to classical physics as this, velocity is considered, start to become small compared to the speed of light, and then you get these corrections. So those sorts of things always kind of need to be in the background of this radical conceptual change. But then even more conservatively, we need to continue to search for sort of whatever low energy anomalies we can get, despite the pessimism that comes from effective field theory that we shouldn't see many of these. But in order to actually find those anomalies, we have to really take this framework that I've just been criticizing actually quite seriously. So there's sort of, again, this is where this tension comes up. So again, another detour. I'm going to talk about theory confirmation in science and how Chris hinted at this a little bit, but how I think that actually works, and that it's not just derive hypothesis, test hypothesis.
Can you explain that painting? I don't know.
It's just a Dolly prompt. I put in closing the loop theory confirmation. I don't remember exactly what the prompt was, but it's a great source if you don't want to have copyright strike pictures and you don't actually care about them being that relevant exactly. So this is just kind of, look, it kind of looks like a closing loop with spiral tightening. It kind of works. But yeah, there's really nothing more to it than that. Again, this is kind of getting back to the conservative stuff that I've been talking about. We should really be very grateful for the people who are really into precision measurements and designing new tests to get that extra decimal place of precision, and then the theorists who construct their expanding the sixth, seventh order QED contributions or wherever we're at now to kind of match those. I think that's really, really important work, not just for like applied science, but actually for these, if we're looking big picture, looking for conceptual change. Again, I'll talk about the analogies to the history of science, but that these, just as a sort of overview first, we think of precision measurement doing a lot more than just confirming a given theory. It's actually when you get these discrepancies that you can either learn more about current theory, or you learn that the current theory is inadequate if they're persistent. And so that's what this closing the loop is. So think about Newtonian like astronomy. You might model the Earth as just orbiting the sun in a two-body problem. That gives you a sort of first-order approximation. But as your measurements get more precise about the position of the sun at different times, you'll realize, oh, there's actually a discrepancy with that sort of two-body model. We need to include more relevant physics. And all of that physics still fits within the Newtonian framework. We include more planets. We include the moon. We include the changing shape of the Earth as it spins. And we actually, we get more and more precise over time. And it's that back and forth sort of between theory and experiment that is it really what's getting us to learn new things about the world. And those things end up actually aren't just confirming the theory, but they often survive theory change. Those are the sort of things, and they also constrain theory change actually as well. They, the exact positions, the really precise astronomical observations that were done in the 1800s are not invalidated by GR. If anything, they survive, and GR has to accommodate and explain them. And again, they also provide the hints like Mercury for going forward. So this is a value of, again, anomaly chasing isn't the right word, but hunting anomalies and looking for persistent ones if done the right way. So we get, we discover anomalies, then we work really hard to resolve them using current theories. And it's only the ones that just stubbornly resist over time that those would be the ones that will point the way to new physics. So this is kind of philosophical background. This is kind of a neo-Newtonian sort of view of how science works. It's not all that new, but it's been developed by, I had people on the last slide, George Smith and Howard Stein. I'll talk about them in a second. But so I've talked about Newtonian astronomy a lot, but here's also something from the Principia, Newton's fourth rule for reasoning, that I think highlights this quite succinctly. So in experimental philosophy, aka science, propositions gathered from phenomena by induction should be considered either exactly or very nearly true, notwithstanding any contrary hypothesis, until yet other phenomena make such propositions either more exact or liable to exception. So the first bit, propose your theory, assume it applies exceptionlessly as generally as possible, really trust it, push it as far as you can, but be ready for the world to push back and tell you that those concepts don't kind of work.
Do you know what he had in mind specifically as an example of that?
So this is
where they're reliable to exception.
So he doesn't have a, I think, so this is kind of justifying the universality of gravity. So there's induction from, it explains, if gravity is a sort of universal force, the same, that's a 1 over r squared thing, the same thing that makes the apple fall is the same thing that keeps the moon in orbit.
So wasn't that he had in mind an example where something that had been very nearly true turned out to be liable to exception?
No, he just thought that it's a good rule to assume, if you're making this induction and you haven't found any exceptions yet, assume it applies to everything, but you obviously can't just be dogmatic in that. He's kind of open to being refuted. I don't think he had anything concrete in mind of an exception. But I think it's kind of in response to people who are critical of his approach to kind of, he didn't didn't provide a mechanism, so that wasn't good enough. He just thought, well, no, if we just observe this regularly, we can apply it with exception. We don't need to.
So is this fair to say that because people criticize him, he invented the rule that they're wrong?
Yeah, so I mean, Chris knows the history of Newton a lot better than I do, but I think, I think it's a good rule. So whether one of the things of even if it's just to shut up his critics, it's I think it's sort of a good rule. But
it seems like an interesting approach that people criticize you just invent a rule that they're wrong.
Cool. Yeah. So there's this whole view of like how the methodology and progress of science goes. I mean, obviously filling in details and making that out, but you can kind of, if you want a slogan, Newton's Rule 4 kind of works there. But Howard Stein and George Smith have really filled this out in very concrete cases. So one thing that we do, or like sort of the sort of filled in recipe, is you have some sort of theoretical framework at the start, so that's kind of, we still don't have like a good, like I said, methodology of discovery, but assume you have a theory to start with, which we're in that position now. It supplies concepts, tools, and motivating problems to solve in some domain of inquiry. You judge its success over time by its ability, again, to have this sort of back and forth, closing the loop style interplay of it being the concepts being used to find new, construct new experiments, to explain new things, maybe build new technologies. Those new experiments might come up with discrepancies that aren't accommodated in the original model, but you update that model over time using the same concepts and tools that were given at the start, close the loop over time. So we can't really determine the success of a scientific program sort of at a time slice. You've kind of got to look at it over a temporally extended time. If it's successful over time in explaining new phenomena or old phenomena with greater precision, that's great. This is where the difference with Kuhn. So Kuhn thinks anomalies just kind of get ignored and swept under the rug until they pile up, and then you've got a revolution. Here, I think this is more accurate to the history of science as well, that anomalies come up all the time, and they're treated very seriously and accommodated, and most of them either, some just kind of get ignored because they're not soluble, but most of them get either accommodated or explained away in some sense. And so that's kind of how we judge the success of a theory. And you have, this sort of back and forth between the theory and the world to refine our concepts, discover new causal details. And so this is a Kuhn quote. This is my secondary goal here is to have you, I'm sure most physicists, if you've done any philosophy of science, you know of Popper and you know of Kuhn. Just to try to say, look, there's more to it than that. So Kuhn talks about the normal science, like the stuff that goes on between revolutions. He doesn't actually mean it that derogatory, but the mopping up of normal science, where it's just kind of filling in the details. I think physicists, scientists in general, can get the wrong impression that the sexy bit is the revolutions and the normal science is boring, and we should be, trying to come up with new theories all the time. But, yeah.
I'm just thinking this sounds a lot like Lakatos. Is it similar?
There's some similarities. Lakatos has I think when you talk about Lakatos in broad enough terms, it sounds good. And then when you actually fill in his details about how he thinks about what a theory is, that it's like a family of sentential models over time and something like that. You could see it as being sort of a change to Lakatos as well. If anyone's heard of Lakatos, this might sound similar. Research programs over time, successful degenerative ones. In broad strokes, I think that's a good way of thinking about it, but I would recommend not filling in the details the way Lakatos does. Kuhn talks about this mopping up of normal science and kind of filling in details, but not only is it the most important stuff, it's also, it gives us our most stable knowledge and it can be the thing that points the way to new physics. So, as a quick aside, we talked a little bit, I think Nyesh mentioned, that Einstein wasn't paying attention to Mercury's anomalous perihelion when he constructed his theory, but that's quite an exception. Einstein spending like 10 years kind of working in working with a small group of people in kind of isolation on his concepts and coming up with a theory that then works out really well is a big, that rarely happens in the history of science. So you think of like quantum theory. As another example, it's these anomalies that come up that are persistent. We try to fit them in classical terms. And those, or like the development of the standard model, you know, we get all these new particles, we don't know how to classify them, we fit in the details. So I do think it's these anomalies popping up and trying to resolve them that really drives progress. And so as a, for the theorists here, it's just to really, you know, don't jump on every first paper discovery of things, but you know, pay attention to where these anomalies are and really, those can be important keys for the way forward. Yeah, so that's, it's kind of basically what I said here. So that's, again, precision measurements allowing for the discovery of new dynamical details that we wouldn't get otherwise. You know, even if, like, even the muon magnetic moment, if that persists as something, you know, it takes generations of getting more and more precise. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's what, the, like, seventh or eighth decimal place for the muon where we start to see discrepancies, something like that. Like, if you didn't do those first five or six decimal places, you're not going to see that. There's this sort of tension that, like, we have to use our best theories to then overthrow our best theories. It's sort of use our concepts until we reach the breaking point, and then there's the hard work of finding new concepts that replace those. Philosophers are often really worried about theory ladenness of observation and have maybe that undermines things. I don't think it does. I don't think you should worry too much about that. We use the concepts we have, and over time those get replaced, but the, you know, the sort of phenomena that you derive from those concepts seem to be stable, at least for physics. Okay, so I said the rest of that. Okay, so for quantum gravity, again, there's this tension. I was talking about the failures of effective field theory and radical conceptual change, but at the same time, we need to really pay attention and trust those current theories and push them to their breaking point to find the sort of empirical signatures that we might need to ultimately test these theories of quantum gravity. Cool. So just overall kind of philosophical conclusions. Like I said, there's this sort of tension between needing to be really open to radical conceptual change, but also needing to take our current theories very seriously. And that can be easily accomplished by having a community of scientists with different attitudes. It's a healthy community when you have these back and forths of people who are strongly supportive of one theory, of the current theory, and others who are kind of pushing in new directions. So specifically for effective field theories, I think one of the lessons is that we should re-examine the assumptions needed to set up the framework, see where those crack, where they fail, and maybe that'll give us the way out, way out in different, maybe different directions in different ways. So Robert pointed to some. We need to keep looking for empirical anomalies despite their stubborn resistance, and then once we find them, keep trying to resolve them. I think what's been going on over the last 10 years or so of particle physics is really healthy, even though it's not been super illuminating to new physics. It's healthy that we find new things and then we work hard. Like, was it the muon? I think there was, like, the day after the discovery paper was announced, there was somebody who dropped a group that published a paper that, if we actually update the hadronic virtual hadron contributions to the correction, it actually really shrinks this gap down to, like, I think it was down, you know, from 4 sigma to 2 sigma or something like that. And it, so that sort of back and forth is really important. It's a sort of mixture of attitudes that are healthy in the community. And so Nyash mentioned about finding agreement on ways to go forward. I disagree with finding agreement. I think disagreement is actually really important. That we need people who are more conservative and that want to hold to current theories to kind of keep the more speculative people in check and vice versa. We need the more speculative people to kind of push the boundaries of our current theories. And again, as a sort of general thing to think about philosophically, you should think of science as a sort of temporally extended enterprise that's sort of predicated on the concepts and theories that we currently have. But that still provide stable knowledge that goes beyond that. Cool. I think that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Very nice. Can you go to slide 24?
Okay. Yeah.
I have a comment, and it is sort of, I think, more essential to what you said, but I don't know how to react to that. The last sentence. Its discoveries made predicated on a theory are more stable than the theories themselves. You didn't say much about that.
Yeah.
This is a point that has always shocked me as in strong contrast with the sort of Kuhnian upper philosophy of science, which is so common among scientists. And the history of science are full of that. I mean, the Earth is not flat, it's round, period. The Earth goes around the sun and not vice versa in some sense, period. There are physical fields, period. We have common ancestors with all the animals, period. And let me go ahead. There is no preferred notion of velocity, absolute, it's velocity is relative, period. The world is described in the general quiet way by the black hole, and so on. So all these things are completely incomprehensible from a strictly Popperian, Kuhnian view of science. So science doesn't work that way. And of course, you are giving us a much better way of viewing science. But the reason I'm saying that is because the overemphasis of the proper Kuhn philosophy of science in this community has as a result that there is a strong push of disregard what has been learned about the universe in trying to guess how the universe works. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I think that this is just wrong. It's like trying to not use what we know. It's like saying, well, suppose the Earth is not round, it's flat. Let's try to do a theory of the universe that way. Well, you might, but the chances that you get something useful seems to be unbelievably small. Mm-hmm. That's why I think these kind of considerations are relevant for today's science.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, because the hard part is in the moment. So there's always, you know, with the radical conceptual change, there's also a lot of continuity in many other respects, right? So we don't know what the key ingredient that's going to need to be changed is, but we do know that whatever it is, it's going to have to match up with our current, what we currently know in the right sorts of ways. And I think, again, that's another hint at that tension where, yeah, we should be looking back and like really appreciating how far we've come and paying attention to those successes. There is going to have to be some change, like, but it's hard to pinpoint in the moment what it is, and I think that's the challenge.
Yes. Here?
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned the hierarchy problem as a way forward. There are some people, well, I know of one, who would say this is not an actual problem worth working on, nor is the cosmological constant problem, because it's not a problem of consistency. And this viewpoint would say good problems in science are ones where there are problems of consistency, but large discrepancy in scale is not a consistency problem. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I think in some sense, right, we have a theory, we can just set the parameters how we want, and that's, I think it's, in one sense, that's fine. That's kind of what I was trying to hint at, maybe not, I didn't articulate super well in the saying that, like, look, our theories are actually more successful than our sort of theoretical backgrounds might indicate. We think if we want to apply sort of renormalization, like think of the standard model as just another effective field theory and use the same methods we use for other lower energy effective field theories, we would expect these parameters that are relevant to depend on the upper limit cutoff scale in some way. So there's an inconsistency, but it depends on how you phrase it. There's an inconsistency of treating, again, maybe, I need to think more about this. Maybe I think naturalness does have to come into play here, because you could just suggest that, oh, like it does depend on the energy scales, and those are just unnatural parameters that are suppressed. So there's some tension there, but it depends on how you phrase it. I think at the empirical level, no, we can just use these theories and it's totally fine. But if that's why I kind of phrase them as theoretical anomalies.
Does naturalness count as a crack? I mean, this viewpoint would say, as I understand it, it would say, no, naturalness is not a crack. Problems dealing with naturalness are just not worth working on. Hundreds of papers have been written on naturalness problems, but this viewpoint contends they're just not worth doing.
Yeah, I guess my one thought would be that I think that's probably the right conclusion to draw, but exactly how you phrase that out in terms of effective field theories, because you could say, well, look, naturalness in all these other cases seems to give us the right sorts of guides of where an effective field theory of phonon-phonon interactions or something roughly would break down. And we don't seem to have any reason to treat the standard model differently, but yet those sorts of reasoning, that sort of reasoning doesn't work. You might say the result, correct thing is to just get rid of naturalness and to keep the effective field theory sort of background. You might say we need to radically revise even further than that. But so yeah, I agree with the conclusion, but I think the way of getting there maybe is slightly different.
I think one more question, and we'll be more
confident. Yes. So the CC problem, do you classify it again as an anomaly or as a?
It's a theoretical puzzle. I call it an anomaly. I consider it more on the side of theory. It's not.
Two comments with that. I guess in response to that, because I don't see it as a natural process. However we deal with it, it's the problem is there because the vacuum energy does not seem to gravitate. So current theories, we do have the vacuum energy. Somehow we have to get rid of it. How we get it to that small value, that's another puzzle. But isn't it similar to what Einstein had to deal with the inertial mass and gravitational mass? Have to match each other so exactly.
I think there's lots of different ways that we can think about trying to resolve the cosmological constant problem, and I think it is a problem with the current setup. Yeah, it's always there. We have a vacuum energy term, in an effective field theory of quantum gravity, and it's going to scale with the fourth power of the cutoff, and why we need some mechanism to set it low. My thought on that is that I think a reformulation of quantum field theory might be helpful there. I think that the expectation value of vacuum energy density is kind of superfluous in quantum field theory, and it's only when you start to try to combine it with gravity that we get these problems. And I don't have an actual solution, but my thought is that the thing I think makes the most sense plausibly is that a reformulation of quantum field theory might get rid of a term like that. And that, again, that involves significant revision to the effective field theory sort of treatment. So yeah, it's still a problem. Given what we know now, given our current theories, it is a problem that needs to be dealt with.
Okay, let's thank Adam again.